Last time, we learned the Feynman rules that allow us to compute scattering amplitudes in just a few minutes, or at least write down an analytic expression that may involve some integrals we haven't yet learned how to do, but we did learn how to write down the analytic expressions for amplitudes using the technique of Feynman diagrams. And today, we're going to do the last step in connecting the amplitudes to things we can observe, namely cross sections and decay rates. And we'll see an example of how to put it all together. We'll compute an amplitude and then a decay rate. So I'd like to begin by just briefly reviewing classical cross sections. So we can imagine that we have some particle accelerator that accelerates a beam of particles, and let's assume that particles that are accelerated are point masses. And we have some velocity v and a density rho b. And for simplicity, let's assume that we just turn the accelerator on for a brief amount of time, so we emit a burst of particles. And so this set of point masses, which have velocity v and uniform density rho b, have a length lb, which is just related to some time t by the speed. And let's suppose these particles are going towards some target particles, which are spheres of radius r. And again, let's assume there's a uniform density rho a, and these particles are uniformly distributed along some length LA, and will work in the frame in which these particles are at rest. And let's assume that A is the cross-sectional area common to both beams. So we can then compute the number of collisions we'll get. So the number of collisions, it should be proportional to the number density per unit area of the target particles. So it should be proportional to rho A LA. It should be proportional to the number density per unit area of the particles of type B. Also, it should be proportional to rho B times LB. Should be proportional to the cross-sectional area common to the two beams. Okay. And then the coefficient is what's known as the cross-section. And if we set the area common to the two beams to be pi r squared, and we assume that the number density in that area is 1, then we should have exactly one collision. There's just one particle that can't possibly miss this sphere, which has a cross-sectional area of pi r squared. So if we want one collision, this factor is 1 over a. This factor is 1 over a. This is a. This should also be a. So in this case, this cross-section is just the cross-section of the sphere. So this is, in this case, sigma is pi r squared. OK. So it's useful to write this in a slightly different form. So write the total number of particles of type A in the common cross-sectional area as rho A times LA times A. And if we do that, then the number of collisions is, just using our formula here, sigma NA NB over A. We can rewrite in a slightly different way as sigma NA NB times VT over the volume in which the collisions occur. So why do this? This lets us compute the probability that there will be a collision, which is what we're going to ultimately relate the amplitude squared to. So with this formula, we can compute the probability of a collision, which is just the number of collisions divided by the product of the number of particles of each type, which, using our result from before, just divide by NA and B on both sides, this gives us sigma VT over the volume. And so this is in a very nice, useful form that will allow us to relate the amplitude squared, related to the probability, to the cross-section, which is what we're interested in computing. So just a lightning review of classical cross-sections. Let's now move on to the QFT case. And so I'll focus on 2 to n scattering. Before, we were focusing on 2 to 2 scattering, which is the simplest case, but 2 to n is not going to complicate things very much, so might as well just consider the general case. And it's extremely difficult experimentally to collide more than 2 particles, so really this is the most general case we're ever interested in, except for particle decay, which I'll come to later in the lecture. As a reminder, our initial state, then we just want to be momentum eigenstates. We've talked about these before when we were discussing the LSE formula. And our final state will be a momentum eigenstate with n particles. And so we almost can immediately generalize this formula. To quantum field theory to get relationship between our amplitude and the cross section. What we would like to write down is that it's just the amplitude squared. One issue we have to take into account is that our initial and final states are not unit normalized. So if we try to interpret this as a probability, we'll run into problems because our states are not unit normalized. So we need to divide by the norm of our initial and final states. Second issue we run into is that, so we've learned how to compute this amplitude for a particular initial state and a particular final state. So that's, we're specifying all of the momenta. That, in general, when we're doing a collision, there's many possibilities for the possible final momenta, possible final momenta. And so we expect that if we specify precisely the final momenta, we'll just get an infinitesimal probability. So we need to, if we're going to get the total probability, integrate this with some measure. And the measure should just take the following form. It's D3PJ for each of the final particles. We have this extra factor of the volume and a 2 pi cubed. So where does this come from? So one way to think about why we have these factors instead of just D3PJ is that if we were doing the same calculation in periodic space, with volume equal to L cubed, the allowed momenta would be quantized, and they would just be equal to 2 pi over L times some vector of integers. And so in that case, what we would do is we would sum over the final, the allowed vectors of integers. And then when we take the continuum limit, the sum just becomes an integral D3PJ times the volume over 2 pi cubed, if we're in three spatial dimensions. Okay. So this then gives us a way to compute the probability. And in a minute, we'll relate this then to the cross section using the classical formula we came up with a few minutes ago. But first, let's think about what we've written down. So we have in the numerator here the amplitude squared. Now, several times we've made the argument that the amplitude should be 2 pi to the fourth, delta to the fourth, times a momentum conserving delta function. Times the matrix element, I times the matrix element. And so if we compute the amplitude squared, we've got the square of a delta function, which is something I told you doesn't make sense back in the front end. So how can we interpret this? Well, we can basically use one of the delta functions to write delta 4 squared, we can think of as equal to delta 4 of 0 times delta 4 that conserves momentum and this delta of 0 is something we've run across already in the second lecture. And so back then, we interpreted a delta of 0 as just an integral d4x e to the I 0 times x, or the volume. Back then it was a spatial volume. Now this is d4x, so it's the volume of space-time. So it's the volume of space times the time. So we'll make this interpretation. We'll say that this problematic factor of delta 4 squared is just coming from the fact that space-time is infinite. That's right. So the interpretation is this is the probability that two initial particles will scatter to some set of final particles. But if we specify the momentum of all the final particles precisely, we'll get there's zero probability for that to happen. So what we'll need to do is integrate over all possible momenta of the final state particles to get the total probability that two initial particles of specified momenta will scatter to a certain
and all of
class.
The answers that we give in the LSE formula, wasn't that meant just to just normalize the initial final state?
What we did in the LSE formula, you know, was not to consider the normalization, but really to consider which states they were. We could choose a different normalization. The normalization we've chosen was chosen to make these amplitudes Lorentz invariant. But if we didn't care about Lorentz invariants, we could still use the LSE formula with a different normalization. It would just give us some additional factors. There would be some additional factors in that formula that would then cancel out of the probabilities.
Here, the initial and final state are all way better.
Can you speak up?
Like, is the initial and final state here is also the way better?
If you like to think about them as wave packets, nothing will really change.
If it is just a plain wave, we cannot find norm between the same state. Like, we cannot do a inner product between the k state with the same k state. It is divergent.
It is divergent, yes. But the divergence is actually going to be precisely the same one we have here. And so I was going to come to that next. If we did consider them wave packets, then we wouldn't have delta functions in here. That's a good point, and let me discuss that now. So the one particle states also contain delta functions, which we can interpret in the same way. These are just three-dimensional delta functions. And so our initial states, which is a two-particle state, will contain a factor of 2ek1, 2ek2 times delta cubed of 0, which is just the volume. Yeah, so if we consider wave packets, we wouldn't have these would be normalizable states, and we wouldn't have this delta function. But since we're already interpreting our amplitude, the delta function of 0 in our amplitude as the volume of space-time. We can do the same thing to interpret the spatial delta function we get in the normalization of our initial and final states in the same way. So for our final state, we'll just get n factors. Of one factor of the energy for each of the particles, and then factor of the volume. Okay. So you can combine these results with our formula for the probability to get following formula. So the probability is related to factor d phi. It's called the phase space measure, which I'll explain in a minute, times the matrix element squared over 2 ek1, 2 ek2. And we're left with a factor of t in the numerator, and one of the factors of volume in the denominator cancel, so we're just left with one factor. So I've only written these 2ek1 and 2ek2 from the initial state. We still have these two epjs from the final state, and additionally, this delta function. And so I'm absorbing all of those factors into what's called the phase-based measure. So this is just the delta function, overall momentum conserving delta function. Times product j equals 1 to n. E3 pj over 2 pi cubed 2 epj. And this is what's called the phase space measure. Okay. Arjun? Where did these go? So these, so I have been a little bit sloppy here. This should have been 2 pi, or this should have been 1 over 2 pi to the fourth. So yeah, so 2 pi to the fourth times delta of 0 should have given us the volume. Sorry about that. Sorry?
This dp is the probability that something happens, right?
Yes.
So that should be something physical.
That's right.
So why is there the volume factor in there, which just seems like an infrared cutoff, which should not enter in our results that we can observe?
Well, so what we're actually going to observe will be the or the interesting quantity that we can observe is the cross section. So how many collisions you get will depend on how many particles you send in. And
we fixed how many particles to send
right, for this probability. Okay, so. Let's see. We'll see these will cancel out of the cross section, but
Or was it because D3P over volume is more physical than just D3P?
That's probably a good way to think about it, yeah. So there's probably some infinities lurking elsewhere in the calculation that would cancel that out precisely where. Lose me at the moment, but we'll see that when we calculate the cross section, these factors will explicitly cancel out. And then, if you wanted to go back from the cross section, you could calculate the probability that if you start with some number of particles, you could compute the probability then. Yeah. So. Based on the classical formula we derived, we know that the infinitesimal probability should be related to the infinitesimal cross section times Vt over the volume. And so combining our results, we see that the infinitesimal cross-section is related to the phase space volume matrix element squared the energy times the velocity, or the speed. And so the phase space is explicitly Lorentz invariant. We see a delta 4 and the Lorentz invariant phase space measure, we've seen many times. The matrix element is also Lorentz invariant. It's related to our Lorentz invariant amplitudes, with a delta 4, Lorentz invariant delta function pulled up. So then there's two options for the denominator. If we want the cross-section to be Lorentz invariant, we can make a Lorentz invariant definition for the speed. And this is one of two different conventions that are commonly used. So if we make this choice, then what we're computing is the Lorentz invariant cross section. Alternatively, we could just let this be the ordinary relative velocity between the two particles. And so you'll see both used sometimes. So this would give us Lorentz invariant cross section. Or this would give us something that transforms like an area. In practice, when you're computing things, you often have to compute these quantities anyway. So this one can be easier to use. It's also the one used by experimentalists. So I'll be using this one. They agree as long as the velocities of the or momenta of the initial particles are collinear, so they're colliding along a line. We'll get the same thing in practice. That's the only case we ever care about.
So. There should be k, right? K1, k2, p1, p2, or something?
Should be k, yes. So,
Dan, in the classical picture, the volume that we used to relate the cross section and the probability mm-hmm. was something like the volume of the beams, right?
Right.
And now in this calculation, the volume is d3 of 0, so the volume of all of space.
That's right. That's because we're considering momentum eigenstates as our initial states. So they.
But now to arrive at this definition of d sigma, we cancel them against each other.
Yes.
But how are this the same, the volume of the beam and the volume of all of space?
Because we are considering momentum eigenstates, which are completely delocalized in space. So if we consider momentum eigenstates, the collision is equally likely to happen anywhere in space. So there really is an infinite volume if we're considering momentum eigenstates. We could consider wave packets to try to localize the collision, the location where the collision is likely to occur. And for calculational purposes, it's easier to consider momentum eigenstates.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, one question regarding the volumes again. Sorry.
Sure.
The normalization is of F. Is there only one factor of volume that shows up, or is there actually n factors of volume that show up?
There's only one factor of volume.
You know that in the definition that you have, that is on the second blackboard on top, you always not see it, you have the product of J going from 1 to n with the volume in there. So that gives you a volume to the n, right? So how are you going to cancel this that you end up just with 1 over volume in the n? So that doesn't seem reasonable to me. Like, I don't see where all these volumes cancel. But the FF is normalized with just the volume. This will normalize also.
Oh, sorry. This here? This should have been just one factor of the volume.
For all the momentum. But with this argument, this shows up for each momentum.
We get a factor 1 over L. So the volume is L cubed. Or we get a factor L for each one.
Yeah, right.
So L cubed is just one factor of the volume.
Yeah,
thanks. Sure. OK. So this is our final formula for a cross section. And in the later part of the lecture, we'll see how to use this, and we'll actually compute some cross sections, a cross section. What is going to change if we're interested in a decay width instead? So simpler thing to compute is a partial decay width. And what does that mean? So total decay rate is defined to be 1 over the lifetime of the particle. Which is equal to a sum over all possible decay channels. Of the partial widths. So a partial decay width basically tells us the rate that a particle will decay to a particular final state. So for instance, we could start with a tau particle. So tau is basically a heavier version of a electron or muon. And among other decay channels, a tau can decay to a muon plus neutrinos or an electron plus neutrinos. So if you want to compute the lifetime or decay rate of a tau, we would need to compute each of the partial decay widths. Decay widths to electrons, to muons, and all of the hadronic decays as well. So these are the simplest quantities related to decay rates that we can compute. And basically, only a few steps for derivation will change. We want to compute the decay width, partial decay width. And the infinitesimal partial decay width should just be probability particle decays in a certain time. And what will change in what we've done before? So we only have one particle in our initial state. So we'll only get one factor of 2e for the initial particle. And so other than that, our derivation basically goes through unchanged. So what we're left with is the same phase space, matrix element, or our one particle state to go to some particular final state squared over 2 EK1. And most often we evaluate this in the center of mass. Sometimes if we want to make this a Lorentz invariance definition, we can just evaluate 2 EK in the center of mass frame, and in which case the infinitesimal partial decay width is just the phase space, it's a matrix element squared over 2n. So this is our formula for decay width. So you may be a little bit concerned because we're considering an unstable particle as our initial state. And remember, throughout our derivation, we were assuming that our initial states were defined asymptotically. So it doesn't seem to make justifications we've made for this formula seem a little bit shaky. We apply to this formula because we can't consider a unstable particle. It's an asymptotic initial state. This formula can be justified in a better way. It will require some more discussion of loops and renormalization. I will leave a better justification of this formula to the future. So we're almost done. We've got formulas for the differential cross-section, the differential decay width. And if we want to get a total cross-section, total decay width, all we need to do is integrate. Which final state should we integrate over? We should integrate over all inequivalent final states. Often, we have identical particles in our final state. So we want to integrate over all inequivalent final states with two options. Either we can restrict the integration over the phase space, or we can just divide by a symmetry factor. This is a additional symmetry factor that is separate from any symmetry factor that shows up in the Feynman diagrams. But if we have two identical particles in the final state, then we would need to, we could restrict the integration. In practice, this can be more difficult than just dividing by a symmetry factor. But if we We have two identical particles in the final state. Instead of integrating over, we can integrate over the entire phase space, d phi, and then just divide by 2 because we've double counted. We can't distinguish if particle 1 has momentum p1 or particle 2 has momentum p2 if they're particle 1 and particle 2 are identical. So that's basically it. We'll see some examples after the break of how to use these formulas. But in principle, these two formulas, together with what we've learned about how to compute the matrix elements, are all we need to compute decay widths or cross sections. Any questions? Let's look at a few, or an example, of how to compute a cross section. And to do that, we'll look at toy theories. So this is a theory that resembles the effective theory that we could use to describe how nucleons, like neutrons or protons, interact with mesons, which are light scalar particles. So since we haven't yet learned how to deal with fermions, we're just going to look at a toy version in which we're going to treat the nucleons as scalar particles. And so our Lagrangian will contain two fields, a complex scalar field, rho, which will play the role of a charged nucleon, a proton, and a neutral scalar field, the meson. So this is the nucleon. Charge, complex scalar field. It's the meson. It's a real scalar. They'll have separate masses, different mass terms. So the nucleon has mass big M, the meson has mass small m. And real nucleons are quite a bit heavier than most mesons. And then we'll add an interaction term. It will assume it is a small perturbation to the theory of a real and a complex scalar field. G is much less than either of the masses. So I mentioned that this, we're going to think of this nucleon as a charged nucleon. And the reason we can do that is because this Lagrangian has a U1 symmetry that rho goes to e to the I theta rho, like we looked at in the first lecture. So this kinetic term respects the symmetry. The mass term does, and our interaction term still has the rho star rho. So this is a symmetry, and therefore there's a conserved charge. So if we want to compute.
In theory, is in some sense completely symmetric, but just the last coupling term is not symmetric, right? So we have only a rho squared pi term, but no pi squared rho term. So that would kill the U1 symmetry also.
That would.
So is that the reason that we don't take it, or is there something else? Like, what's the physical reason that you only take that direction?
The physical, so that would mean that we would lose the interpretation of rho as being a charged particle. So we would break that. So if we want to have a charged particle, we cannot add that term. We'll talk more about what kind of terms are reasonable to write down later. But this is something we'll talk about in QFD2. If you take a theory with some symmetries and renormalize it, in general, you'll generate other terms that are consistent with the symmetries, even if you didn't write them down initially. If you don't impose the symmetries, you'll just get all possible renormalizable terms. But it's a consistent thing to do if we want to have a particular symmetry to not write down the terms that don't have that symmetry. Okay, so if you want to compute a cross-section in this theory, the first thing we need to do is determine the Feynman rules. And what we really need are the momentum space Feynman rules that will allow us to directly write down the amplitude to any given order. So one property of this theory is we have two fields like you did in tutorial. So we have two different types of lines we can draw. One thing that's new about this theory compared to the theory you looked at in tutorial yesterday is we have a complex field that carries a charge. And so the nucleon will be the rho field. I'll draw the line with an arrow on it denoting the flow of charge. And with a separate arrow, I can indicate the direction of the momentum. And we know, from an earlier tutorial, Feynman propagator for a charged or a complex scalar field takes the same form as it does for a real scalar field. So for every internal line, we get the factor of 1 over k squared, I over k squared minus m squared. I'll denote the lines that have mesons on them, dotted lines, and that's just the usual Feynman propagator with the mass of the meson, which is different from the mass of the nucleon. We have one vertex, so our interaction term has one phi field, one rho field, and one rho star field. So this is our only allowed vertex. And we get a factor of minus ig. We're working in momentum space, so we just get a factor of the coefficient, the factor of minus I that comes from the fact we need to go to the Hamiltonian, and then there's a minus I in the time-ordered exponential. Our external lines are 1, as usual. And then we have the standard rules that are the same for every theory. So momentum conservation at each vertex. We divide by the symmetry factor. And integrate over undetermined momentum. All right. So given the rules, we can compute a matrix element, and from there, we can compute a cross-section. So one cross-section we could compute is the nucleon-nucleon cross-section. Where our initial state and our final state both have two nucleons. So the first thing we need to do is compute the matrix element. So I'll draw Feynman diagrams of time going upwards. And so our initial state has two nucleons. Our final state also has two nucleons. So the direction of the arrow will tell us whether we have a nucleon or an antinucleon. An incoming nucleon should have a arrow going upwards, outgoing nucleon should have an arrow going upwards. And we need at least two vertices to get a connected Feynman diagram. So draw two vertices. Both have one incoming and one outgoing arrow. And then we just need to, so this will give us a contribution to the matrix element of order g squared. Let us figure out all the possible ways we can connect our initial and final particles to our vertices. So there's one very obvious way. We just connect them like this. And so this gives us one possible diagram. And I'll call the initial momentum k1 and k2, final momentum p1 and p2. And the momentum of the meson is determined, and it's k1 minus p1. We also have a second diagram of the same order. So if we again draw our initial and final nucleons, draw our vertices. The other possible way we could connect the diagrams is if connect this one to this vertex, connect this vertex to the final particle 2, connect this one to final particle number 1. And we're left with this other diagram. This is the only other possibility at this order. And the difference is that the momentum of the meson now is k1 minus if we went to higher order, we'd get more diagrams.
Question?
Yes.
So there would also be the diagram where nothing happens, and we just have two bubbles on this, but this doesn't count because we amputate these guys.
So that would be disconnected, so it won't contribute to scattering. It'll also have a vacuum diagram. So the vacuum diagrams, remember, cancel between the numerator and the denominator when we're using the time ordered exponentials to compute endpoint function. So we can write the matrix element using our Feynman rules. So both terms have two vertices and no symmetry factors. So there's no symmetries of either of these diagrams. The first diagram has one internal line. So we get I over k1 minus p1. Minus the mass of the meson, The second diagram has also one internal line, just with a different momentum. And so that's our matrix element. We can then plug this in to our formula for the differential cross-section. D sigma is d phi matrix element squared over, using the Lorentz invariant definition, p1 of p2 squared minus m to the fourth. And because we have two identical particles in our final state, we're going to add a symmetry factor of a half. Then we can integrate over the entire phase space, which will be much easier than having to worry about integrating over some fraction of the phase space. So this comes from the fact that we have two identical particles in the final state. So the next thing we need to do is try to simplify our phase space. So remember, phase space, which I'll denote by d phi 2, or two-body phase space, as a momentum-conserving delta function.
Exactly. So just ask you to repeat the argument of the 1 over 2. And also, the I thought it shouldn't be k1, k2 inside the square root.
Yes, it should. Thank you. K is our initial particle. So what we want to do, if we want to get the total cross-section, is we want to integrate over all possible momenta of the final particles. If we have two identical particles, if we just integrate over all possible vectors, calling p1 and p2, integrate over all p1 and p2, I'm double counting. Because if particle 1 has momentum p1 in this direction, particle 2 is p1 and momentum p2 in that direction, it's the same as if I reversed the labels of the particles. They're identical particles, so we're double counting. And I've just compensated for that double counting by introducing a factor of a half. Alternatively, I could restrict the range of integration of some of these. That's harder to do. So. Not significantly, but not as easy as just putting a half there. OK, so we need to do an integral of this thing. Now, this is Lorentz invariant. So we can evaluate this in any frame. And a particular convenient frame to work in is the center of mass frame. Simplify our calculation a lot. So in our center of mass frame, we have k1. Plus k2 is 0. And the energies of our initial particles are the same. And let's just give their common value a name, E. So some of these integrals are very easy to do. So we have a four-dimensional delta function here. And we can do three of these integrals very easily using this delta function. So let's do that. So integral d phi 2. Well, let's use that to do the p2 integral. We'll get, so we have 4 factors of 2 pi here, 6 factors down there, so we're left with 1 over 2 pi squared, 2 ep1, k. Sorry, these should be k's. No, p's. 2 ep2. And the delta function we're left with is just the zeroth component of that delta function. So we've got ep1 plus ep2, both k10 and k20 are e, so we get minus 2e, and e3p1. Just used the three of the delta functions to do the integral. You'll do the general case in tutorial, but for simplicity, we're just going to consider the relativistic limit now. And so the relativistic limit being that energy is much greater than the mass of the nucleons, which means that EP1, approximately P1, approximately EP2. So you want to preserve the interpretation of the this being a toy model of interactions of nucleons and mesons. We know nucleons are heavier than mesons, so if it's the energy is much greater than the mass of the nucleons, it should also be much greater than the mass of the mesons. In which case, then all of the particles are essentially massless, and all of the energies are just equal to the magnitude of the three momentum.
Understand integral sign missing the first line? Because the integral d by 2, we're integrating over all p, right?
Yeah.
So there shouldn't be anything infinitesimal left?
Yeah, there should be an integral over here. Okay. So we do that. Then this integral of d phi 2 simplifies, and we get a 1 over 16 pi squared p1 squared p1 squared d omega integral of this. Delta 2p1 minus 2e dp1. And we can then do the dp1 integral, remembering that delta of f of x is delta of x minus xi over sum over I of f prime of xi, where f of xi is 0. So we'll get an extra factor of 2 from this integral. And what we're left with is that this, so these p1s cancel. This integral will give us a 1/2. And what we're left with is the integral d omega over 32 pi squared. So it's a very simple result. We just need to do an angular integral. And this will allow us to compute. The cross section. So find that the differential cross section d sigma d omega, then using our previous results, is just g to the 4, 256 pi squared e squared of our matrix element squared, 1 over k1 minus p1 squared, plus 1 over k2 k1 minus p2 squared, all squared.
Sorry, Ben. I don't see why you can start integrating one side without using the expression for m, and then just truncate your integration and send it back to the other side.
Like, well, so we're basically just using the delta function to do some of the integrals. So as long as we make the replacement, use the same delta functions to set, to eliminate some of the variables over here, then we're OK. If it was in general, like if we tried to go further than this, we would run into problems. But because we've only simplified using the delta functions.
What does it mean you're even going further than this?
Well, we could say that this integral is, this d, integral d omega is 4 pi. So we try to do that. This will, in general, depend on the angles.
Right, and also p squared and all that,
and
which you just integrated out. So
we just integrated out, but we as long as we impose this delta function on whatever else we're integrating, then it doesn't matter that whether or not this is there.
Okay.
And we'll do that now. So we do have K1 and P1 over here. We've eliminated some of those using delta functions, so let's make the same replacements here. So we're working in the center of mass frame. So that means we can write K1 as EK and K2 as E minus K. Similarly, P1 and P2, the same energy. And let's call spatial part of the momentum P and minus P. Now, since we're working in the relativistic limit, means that all of these vectors, four vectors, should square to 0. And that tells us that E and K both have magnitude E. So we need to evaluate these, the square of K1 minus P1. So that will contain two terms, one that's, or several types of terms. It will contain a K1 squared, which is 0, a K2, P1 squared, which is 0. And so only the cross term will survive. So what we need to evaluate then is K1.P1 for this term and K1.P2 for that term. And so K1.P1, using our expressions here, is just E squared minus p dot k. And so we just need to set up a coordinate system now.
Why do they square to 0? They're not like, are they? Shouldn't they square to m squared?
We're making the assumption. We're working in the relativistic limit where the masses are negligible.
Compared to what?
Compared to the center mass energy. So we're assuming they're in the center mass frame. The velocities of both the incoming particles and outgoing particles is very close to c, to 1. It's a simplifying assumption, and we'll see that it's going to come back to haunt us in a minute.
The problem I have with this assumption is also that it's a very non-covariant statement. Because it's saying, like, in one frame, the particle is super fast, so E is much greater than, like, the mass. But the square of the four momentum is a Lorentz invariant, right? It should always be m squared.
So if you like, ECM squared is much greater than m squared and m squared. This is a covariant state.
Sure, but then
this is not m over e, it's just m.
Yeah.
It's a Lorentz invariant.
Like, I'm not doing any comparison of m and e now, right? K1 squared is just, I mean, where does the center of mass energy appear there? It's
If you like, we can just think about, we're going to a different theory where we're setting m to m and both m's to 0. That's another, in principle, reasonable theory of the right time.
Is the Stedman cross-sectional or is invariant?
The differential cross-section. So with this definition, so I made one of the two choices of the relative velocity, it is Lorentz invariant. There's
1 over E.
So this E is the center of mass energy. This is ECM. The energy of each particle in the center of mass. Half the center mass energy. The reason I'm just setting all the masses at 0 is just to simplify the calculation. It's not something you would really want to do, and we'll see a concrete problem with it in just a minute. But in tutorial, the algebra we did here would be more complicated if I kept the masses. For simplicity of presentation, set the masses to 0. And so in our massless theory, we can relate p dot k back to the energy by introducing a coordinate system. So let's assume that the so we're in the center mass frame, so the initial particles collide collinearly. And let's assume that the final particles go off at some angle. And let's call the angle between k and p theta. And if we do that, then k1 dot p is just e squared times 1 minus the cosine of theta. And k1 dot p2 is just e squared plus p dot k, which is e squared times 1 plus cosine theta. And then that gives us a formula for cross-section. So this expression. This gives us the differential cross section, and all we would have to do to compute the total cross section is just integrate this over all possible angles. Can't do that, unfortunately, because we would get a divergent quantity. This would diverge if we tried to integrate it. And that's related to the fact that we set all the masses to zero. So this theory with all the masses set to zero has what's known as an infrared divergence. It's a topic we'll come back to and we'll discuss in the week after QFT2. So basically what's going on is when we have massless particles that real detectors can't distinguish how many particles you have. If they're massless and have extremely low energy or are collinear with other particles. So in these cases, we'll get a divergent quantity, and it's related to the fact that this cross-section by itself is not observable. If we put in the masses, we'll get a finite answer. So that would be an observable quantity. We remove the IR divergences, and you'll go through a very similar calculation in tutorial. And you'll get a manifestly finite answer. Again, the reason I set the masses to zero is just to simplify some of the algebra. The steps you would do, keeping the masses would be the same. Just add 20 or 30 minutes of algebra that wouldn't be particularly enlightening. So. OK. So in the last few minutes, I just want to ask a question about what would happen if we instead were interested in the scattering of nucleons and antinucleons. So you might suspect that there should be a close relation between what happens if we scatter two nucleons and a nucleon and an antinucleon. After all, an antinucleon should be very closely related to a nucleon. They're the same type of particle, one's the antiparticle of the other. Let's see precisely what that relationship is in terms of the scattering. Okay, so first of all, we already know the Feynman rules. So we just need to figure out what diagrams we can draw. If we have an initial nucleon and an initial antinucleon, and a final antinucleon and a final nucleon. So first of all, we can draw a diagram that looks very similar to the one we had before. So both vertices have one conserved charge. They have one incoming arrow and one outgoing arrow. So this vertex conserves a charge, this one does. Again, time is going upwards. So this diagram looks the same as before. And we can't draw the same as the second diagram we had before. If we look at the second diagram and we reverse the arrow of P2 and reverse the arrow of K2, then the first vertex has two arrows going in. It doesn't conserve charge. The second vertex has two arrows going out, so that doesn't conserve charge either. So we can't draw a diagram like that. We can, however, draw a second diagram like this. So we can connect our two initial particles together, our one vertex and our two final particles together. Add a single vertex. Okay. And so our matrix element, well, I am of row k1 plus row star of k2, going to row of p1 plus row star of p2. This, again, each term has two vertices, no symmetry factors. First diagram is actually precisely the same. And we get an answer that is almost precisely the same as we had before. The first term is exactly the same. The second term is the same if we replace k2 with minus p2. And so what we see is that the matrix element for nucleon scattering is the same as the matrix element for nucleon antinucleon scattering if we just exchange some of the momentum. So we see that this matrix element is equal to the matrix element for nucleon antinucleon scattering if we just keep these two momenta the same and exchange the momenta of exchange the labels of the momenta of the nucleon and of the antinucleons. Switch this on. So these two matrix elements are precisely the same. So if we're in our expression here, we replace k2 with minus p2, and also p2, which doesn't appear, with minus k2. We get precisely the same matrix element we computed before for nucleon-nucleon scattering. And so this is an example of a very general property of and powerful property of matrix elements. So this is an example of what's known as crossing symmetry. And so crossing symmetry relates matrix elements with a particle in the initial state to matrix elements with the antiparticle with the opposite form momentum in the final state. So, in general, we have some particle in the initial state. The matrix element is precisely the same as if we keep everything else the same, but just remove that particle from the initial state, add its antiparticle to the final state with the opposite form momentum. So remember, for real scalar fields, they're their own antiparticles. Complex scalars, phi bar is phi star. So why is this true? It's actually not too hard to see. We just think about our Feynman rules for scalar fields. So let's suppose we have in some particular diagram that contributes to this matrix element. We have a particle phi going in with momentum p. And it's interacting with some particles with momentum, say, q1 to qm. Fine rules would tell us to write down precisely the same expression if we had the same diagram, just with a final particle that has momentum minus p, interacting with the same particles, momentum q1 up to qn. So the Feynman rules are precisely the same for these two diagrams. And in fact, this is general. It works for fermions and H bosons as well. For fermions, the arguments are slightly more involved than this. We have to worry about the signs we get, which Tibor will tell you about later in the week. A few comments about this. So notice that if one of these, one side of the equation, the energy, say the energy of the initial particle is positive, the energy of the final antiparticle will be negative. So only one side of this equation will in general correspond to a physically allowed process. Up here we used it twice. So if we use it twice, we can relate an amplitude for one physically allowed process to an amplitude for another physically allowed process. But if we only use it a single time, in general, only one side will be physically allowed. And a further comment is to note that this is a statement about matrix elements, not about cross-sections. So in general, even if we use it several times, like we do here, the phase space could be, in general, different. So we might, the kinematics of the interaction could be different. And it's not necessarily true that two scattering processes that are related by crossing symmetry have the same cross-section or decay rate. It's only a statement about matrix elements. So that's all I wanted to say about cross-sections and decay rates. We'll have some practice and tutorial today that also give you extra practice using Feynman diagrams and some homework that will go out soon to have some more practice. And then in my final lecture tomorrow, I wanted to say a few more things about loops. So we mentioned we're discussing the LSE formula, some assumptions. And we had these extra factors of Z and Y that I argued had to show up when we added an interaction to our interaction term to our Lagrangian. And I just set them all to 1. So that was valid at tree level. What happens when we go to loop level, we'll see tomorrow. Thanks. See you in tutorial.